From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Joe Torre. This fall, he led the New York Yankees to its third World Series win since 1996, when he became the team's manager. It was a remarkable season for Torre, who was diagnosed with prostate cancer during spring training. We'll talk about his life in baseball. He has a new book about his rules for winning. Also, actor Philip Seymour Hoffman discusses his roles in Boogie Nights, Next Stop Wonderland, Happiness, and the new film Flawless. And Ken Tucker reviews the new double CD by Nine Inch Nails. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Thousands of protesters have disrupted the opening of the World Trade Organization conference in Seattle. Police used pepper spray to clear the way for delegates from 135 countries. Protesters say increased free trade will undermine environmental standards and worker rights. In New Orleans, a federal arbitrator has certified that a majority of the 4,200 workers at the Avondale shipyard have signed petitions to join the AFL-CIO. The decision gives the metal trades union the right to bargain collectively on behalf of the workers and ends 6 years of bitter fighting between the company and its workers. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
Workers at Avondale Shipyard originally voted to join the union in 1993, but the company has since fought the union every step of the way. Avondale, located just outside New Orleans, is a major Navy contractor and the only one whose workers are not unionized. In 1997, the National Labor Relations Board ratified the workers' vote, but the company then appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Avondale's fight against the union created some controversy when it was discovered that Avondale was allowed to bill American taxpayers more than $5.4 million for legal fees through its contracts with the U.S. Navy. The tide turned earlier this year after Avondale was purchased by Litton Industries. Litton gave the union a year to sign up workers, but it took the metal trades union just 5 weeks to get its majority. Wade Goodwin, NPR News.
The United States has handed over its last remaining military base in Panama today, the Army's Fort Clayton. From Panama City, NPR's Philip Davis has this report.
To the strains of a military band, an honor guard raised Panama's flag over the fort, one of the oldest in the canal zone. The 2,000-acre base has more than 1,000 buildings, including residences, schools, and even a golf course. Today, though, the base is nearly deserted. A skeleton crew of Army security officers still working here have all moved into local hotels until they leave at the end of the month. Panama, though, has big plans for the facility. It wants to turn it into a city of knowledge with a complex of universities that will sponsor research and development on transportation, technology, and the environment. The big prize, though, will come at the end of the month when Panama takes control of the canal itself. Philip Davis, NPR News, Fort Clayton, Panama.
FBI forensic experts joined Mexican soldiers and ski-masked police today in searching two desert ranches near the border for bodies of more than 100 Mexican and U.S. citizens. Authorities say the missing may be victims of a drug gang. Mexico's attorney general said that while the number of bodies in the ranches is unknown, the number of people reporting missing in the area is about 100. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell today, closing 70 points lower at 10,877. This is NPR. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Bradley says Vice President Al Gore's health care plan is inadequate. The remarks were part of the former New Jersey senator's strongest rebuttal yet to Gore's attacks on Bradley's health care proposals. New Hampshire Public Radio's Doug McPherson reports.
At a healthcare forum in Manchester this morning, Bradley said his plan, unlike Gore's, would cover all children right away, would follow workers from job to job, and would replace Medicaid with something better.
The lesson that our leaders, Al Gore, seemed to have learned from the healthcare defeat of 1992 was that a big, bold solution to our national problems cannot happen in Washington. So let's do a few small, symbolic things. But that was the wrong lesson.
Bradley said it's the task of leadership to point the way and get there, quote, come hell or high water. Gore has charged that Bradley's plan is too expensive and would dismantle Medicaid. Tonight, Bradley plans to answer voters' questions on the internet. For NPR News, I'm Doug McPherson in Manchester, New Hampshire.
A Supreme Court justice has temporarily blocked two states from enforcing laws that ban some late-term abortions. Justice John Paul Stevens' order will stay in effect in Wisconsin and Illinois for now. In the meantime, abortion providers will seek a Supreme Court review of a federal appeals court decision that upheld the laws last month. A federal judge in Michigan has approved Dow Corning's $4.5 billion plan to emerge from bankruptcy. It includes a more than $3 billion settlement between Dow Corning and thousands of women with silicone breast implants. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Throughout Joe Torre's long baseball career, he hoped to make it to the World Series, but he didn't get there until after more than 4,200 games, when in 1996, during his first season managing the New York Yankees, he led the team to their first World Championship since 1978. They won again last year and this year. Before joining the Yankees, Torre managed the St. Louis Cardinals and the Atlanta Braves and played for a total of 17 seasons with the Braves, Cardinals, and Mets. He was named the National League's Most Valuable Player in 1971. Now Torre has a new book called Joe Torre's Ground Rules for Winners. I asked him how winning the World Series compares to what he imagined it would be like.
Well, first off, when you've played baseball, and let's put it this way, you've been involved in baseball for over 30 years, knowing that the one thing that was missing was getting to the World Series. I mean, this to me was nirvana. And then once you get there, of course, you want to win. And then when you do win, it's absolutely the best feeling in the world, probably better than you anticipated it would be, probably because it relieved all that baggage you've been carrying around as the missing part of it. And then when you do it 3 out of 4 years, it's absolutely nuts. I mean, it's just something that I can't describe, and it just gives you a different feel. The way you act, basically. It's just it keeps a smile on your face constantly, I think, is the best way to describe it.
This is a difficult season for you. You were diagnosed with prostate cancer just before the season started, and you had have surgery and then recuperate for a couple of months. Does the relative importance of baseball change when you're facing, you know, a possibly life-threatening illness?
No, there's no question. The perspective, realizing that what you're doing on the field is just a game, and even though you'd still go out there and sell your soul for a win in a key situation, it still certainly allowed me just to let it go. I mean, if we had a tough loss, which we did in the middle of the year against the New York Mets, about an hour and a half later, the loss in my mind was gone, and I think that was a change for me.
You know, you were diagnosed with a prostate cancer, I think, just before spring training. Were you afraid that even if you were able to go back to work, which of course you were, that people would lose confidence in your stamina and question whether you could, you know, give enough for the season or even be healthy enough for the season? I'm wondering what Steinbrenner had to say to you about that.
Well, I'll be perfectly honest with you, Terry. I didn't know. First of all, baseball is the furthest thing from my mind when I was diagnosed. I mean, I didn't know if I was going to come back. I didn't care if I was going to come back. I had to take care of this before I could really think about what my future was going to be. I was more concerned that I had a three-year-old daughter, Andrea, that I wanted to be around for. That was my first priority. And as far as George Steinbrenner, every time I had to go someplace to get a scan or an X-ray, and get test results, George was right there for me. And you know, I know you hear a lot of horror stories about George Steinbrenner, but, you know, he was a rock for me, and I really appreciated that. As far as going back to manage, I didn't know how it was going to feel. I can be perfectly honest with you. I was going to wait until my stamina did come back. That's the one thing. When you go through surgery, your blood count goes down, so you're anemic. And I came to the ballpark every single day that we were at Yankee Stadium. and watched from upstairs and mingled around the players. I thought it was important that the players see that I'm walking around and see that I feel pretty good and a little tired, a little weak. And I got myself to the point where doctors told me I can go back anytime I felt like it. And I think I probably waited 3 weeks beyond that, only because once you go back, there's no looking back. You 7 days a week. You can't be saying, well, I can rest up on the weekend. So I knew before I decided to go back, I had to be 100% sure that my endurance was going to be there. And I never had a problem once I put the uniform on. And I happened to put the uniform on in Boston. My first game back, I was sitting with my wife the night before having dinner. I said, I'm thinking of going to work in a couple of days. She says, if you're thinking about it in a couple of days, why not tomorrow? And that's what happened. I had dinner, spent the night at home, flew up to Boston the next day, and the players walked in and saw me in uniform. And it was just the way I wanted it, basically. No fanfare, and let's just go play baseball.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Torre, manager of the Yankees, now author of a new book called Ground Rules for Winners. You grew up in Brooklyn. What team did you and your family root for?
We rooted for the New York Giants, which was very dangerous.
It was dangerous?
Well, you live in Brooklyn. Yeah. You're either a Dodgers fan or a Dodgers fan.
Mm-hmm.
Being the youngest of five children, I did what my older siblings did, and everybody rooted for the Giants, the Willie Mays people, and that was good enough for me. In 1951, when Bobby Thompson hit that home run off Ralph Branca, I was 11 years old, and it was quite a celebration in our house, not in our neighborhood, but in our house. And then when the Giants and Dodgers moved out after the 1957 season, it was pretty quiet here. All we had were the Yankees, and the Yankees used to win every year, so they weren't really fun to root for because they would win all the time. Of course, by that time, my brother Frank was playing with the Milwaukee Braves, and I was a Braves rooter for that reason. But we've been a baseball household from day one, and I was fortunate because of my brother Frank and my dad, who used to be a detective. Would get tickets for postseason games, World Series games, and I got to see quite a few of them.
Now, you write about how your father had a very bad temper, and you say that although he never physically abused you, he did verbally abuse you, and I guess he occasionally hit your mother. Was controlling your temper on the field ever an issue?
No, I'd snap every once in a while, but I was never a confrontational person. I didn't like confrontation. I didn't like loud noises. I didn't like loud banging, phone calls in the middle of the night. And I have to think in growing up in my house, that was part of the fright that my father brought to the house every day. He'd sleep late, he'd get in late at night. If you made any noise, you would hear him. Again, I was never physically abused, but sometimes maybe being physically abused isn't as bad as the fright from thinking you will be and being screamed at all the time.
Well, what did the boys do when your mother was hit?
Well, I don't know. The boys weren't around. I think he just did that in front of my older sister, Ray, who was pretty much alone with my mom in the house with my dad and myself. I never witnessed it myself, but I was told that she was hit. I know he used to have a gun in the house because he was a policeman, and he used to go to that drawer a number of times. I remember that vividly, and it was scary for me. It still gives me goosebumps when I think of it.
How old were you when your older brother Frank got to the minor leagues?
I was 10 going on 11 when he was he played in Denver, which was the Class A affiliate of the Milwaukee Braves. I remember visiting him for a month or so with my sister, an aunt, and a cousin. We took a train from New York to Denver. My aunt was afraid to fly at the time, and I didn't get in an airplane myself until I was 16, and I flew to Milwaukee in my brother's first year with the Milwaukee Braves. But I was fortunate. Frank played A baseball in Denver, and then he He went to the service for 2 years. He went to Korea and came out and then played in Atlanta in 1954. I was 14 years old. And then in Toledo in 1955. And I went to both places, worked out with him. As I say, it made you feel like you were part of the team. And it was those opportunities that made me feel like I wanted to do this.
What made the biggest impression on you as a kid when you visited your brother?
Well, I think just the baseball life. He was more, my brother Frank was more of a role model for me. He always was, always ate in the best restaurants. That always made an impression on me. I think that's where I got fat, eating with him all the time. But he was always a big tipper and things I've tried to emulate and you know, walk around with a lot of class and do things like that. But I think it was just the baseball lifestyle, being able to meet the big leaguers like Warren Spahn and Eddie Matthews and Hank Aaron. And then finally, a few years later, being their teammates. But I think the big impression for me was the baseball aspect of it.
My guest is Joe Torre, manager of the Yankees. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Torre, manager of the Yankees, and he's led the team to three World Series championships in the past 4 years. He has a new book now called Ground Rules for Winners. In your memoir, you described yourself as a shy, overweight kid, and I think you were rejected by the first scout who saw you play as being too fat and too slow. Did you feel like you had to work at changing yourself before you got to play?
Well, I had to change a position. There's no question. I was a third baseman. I was a first baseman, and I pitched in high school. But when I was 16 years old, I think I weighed 240 pounds. I had a 40-inch waist, and, of course, I wasn't fast. And so I became a catcher. I think I was 17 or 18 years old. I became a catcher. And it seemed that if you have a little extra girth on you, that catching is a spot that, you know, you'll be able to handle, and your speed isn't that big of a factor, so you don't worry about it as long as you can hit. And I was a pretty good hitter. So my brother Frank used to embarrass me. I didn't like my brother Frank. I mean, he was a role model for me, but he was very critical of me and always was a tough taskmaster, because I think he wanted me to grow up, get in shape, and not having a father in the house during my teenage years, he sort of took on that role and thought that he should be, more of a disciplinarian than my mom would be. So I didn't realize it until later on that he was doing this for my benefit. So it was sort of a love-hate relationship, I guess.
Did you play on the Braves together at the same time?
Only in spring training, unfortunately. We played together in the spring of 1961, which was the year I wound up with the ball club toward the end of May. And then Frank was in the minor leagues at that time. He had been in the big leagues from 56 through 59 and part of 60, and then was sent to the minor leagues. And then we played against each other when he came back to the big leagues. He wound up at the Philadelphia Phillies in 1962, and that's where we played against each other. But the only time we played side by side, he played first and I caught, was in spring training games in 1961.
And what was that like?
Oh, it was fun. It was fun because a lot of the players, we used to have like A squad and B squad, and the B squad would be the squad that used to travel. And Charlie Dressen, who was our manager, put a lot of good players in that B squad. Hall of Famer Warren Spahn. There was the regular shortstop Johnny Logan. Billy Martin was on that team. And I remember catching one particular day. I hit two home runs against the Washington Senators in spring training, and I was catching Warren Spahn. And I remember calling. We had some mix-ups with the signal calling. And then Warren Spahn throws a curveball, and somebody hits a home run, and my brother Frank called me out in front of Warren Spahn and says, you know, we called him Hooks, that's his nickname, but we call him Hooks because he has a crook, hook nose, not because he can throw the curveball. So it was a great time being on that B squad. I was a 20-year-old kid and really learning a lot on those bus trips, believe me. It was it stayed with me.
Say you called a pitch and Warren Spahn shrugged you off. Would your confidence be shaken by that?
No, because we talk about it. We talk about it. We had a lot of fun with it. We had a special. We always put a special type of sign together. We would change signs on every pitch, something to keep the game from being boring. But Warren Spahn didn't shake me off very often. And I think I come to realize it later on. He had such good control that even if he didn't want to throw a pitch, he probably wouldn't throw it for a strike. But he made me feel very comfortable. I think a big part of that, Terry, was the fact that I had met them when I was 16, 17 years old. And when I first came to the big leagues in 1961, Warren Spahn and Lou Burdette used to sort of take care of me because my brother wasn't around. They'd take me to movies during the day and just made sure I stayed out of trouble.
Yeah, but sometimes they'll just keep thinking of you as the kid if that's the way they first know you.
Well, yeah, you're right. They did. They always did. And in fact, when I went into slumps, you know, they would come over and make sure I wouldn't get down and, again, poke me from behind. They just didn't let me wallow in it. They paid attention to me. I think that was a big benefit for me.
Do you think catching is a good experience for managing because you're a strategist and also you can see the whole field from your vantage point?
No question. I think the manager probably picks on the catcher more than any other position because he does handle the pitchers, and the pitchers, pitching is 85% of the game. The reason that we've been successful here over the last 3 or 4 years is the fact that we could pitch better than anybody else consistently. So because pitching is so important, I put a lot of weight on my catcher's shoulders, and I think that catchers probably are more aware of how the game is played than any other position.
Any injuries you're left with from catching, crouching for so long, the impact of receiving the ball?
Well, I probably wake up my wife every night when I get up during the night to do one thing or another because my knees will click and crack and everything else. But for the most part, just a couple of broken fingers and some loose knees, but no major surgery that debilitated me or made me go to another position.
It's hard to crouch for so long?
It hurt my feet more than anything else. I have flat feet, and when you try to squat down, the knees didn't bother me as much as my feet did. You live with it. When you go out there and you try to get in shape for the job you do, you really stuff like that really doesn't bother you because you know it's part of what you need to do to do your job.
Are there things that I know there's a lot that's changed in baseball since you started playing. Are there things that you wish could be the way they were when you were starting out?
Well, I don't know. I go back to before we had a Players Association when certain teams used to limit you to the number of towels you're allowed to use. So I think we've come a long way. The only thing I think I would like to have the players understand is why they're making this money, that players had played this game before they did. Some of them, think they have this coming to them, and to me that's a bad attitude to have because you're not really sure other than your agent telling you that you can get this and you can get that, but I think you have to go beyond that. So I'd like to have the players understand where this all came from, understand the players like Curt Flood who, did something because he thought it was the right thing and sat out a year of baseball because he didn't think it was the right thing to get traded. So a lot of the rules have changed because of Curt Flood, but Curt passed away a couple of years ago, and he lost his Supreme Court case. But what he did played a big, big part in what the players are enjoying today.
Managers spend a fair amount of time on television during a game, especially a tension-filled game like in the World Series. And I'm wondering if you're conscious of the fact that, oh, the camera's on me now. I mean, here you are in like your moment of anxiety. And are you aware when the camera's on you and when it's not? And does it matter to you?
Well, you've got to ignore it. You know, you watch other games on television. You see how much they show the manager in those games. So you have to assume that it's on you all the time. I mean, there are so many cameras. So even if the one next to the dugout isn't on you, then maybe the one across the field is on you. But watching football, watching basketball, watching all the sports, and you see when something happens on the court or on the field, how they go right to the manager for a reaction. And I'm aware of that, and I don't want that reaction, because if a player strikes out with the bases loaded or a ball goes through his legs with the bases loaded, you know, he's trying. And I don't want later on the news to have that player see his manager have a disgusted look on his face. I'd rather pass on that one.
Do you try to just look as neutral as possible?
Yeah, people accuse me of being asleep and all that kind of stuff. But I tried to just not show emotion. I know I kid with a lot of people. I say, why don't you have a smile? I said, because George Steinbrenner doesn't want to see you have a good time. I just talk a lot with my bench coach, Don Zimmer, and my pitching coach, Mel Stottlemyre, who are two of the best in the game. And believe me, there are days when you second-guess yourself as a manager with decisions, but being able to talk it out with a Zimmer and with a Stottlemyre before you even make that decision makes that second-guessing hold to a minimum because of, going in when you use somebody as a sounding board. But again, I don't like to show emotion. I didn't do it as a player, to be honest with you, because I didn't want to give the pitcher the satisfaction of knowing he aggravated me. I'm not sure it was the right thing to do, but it was the way I did it.
So, Joe Torre, one last question. Are you already looking ahead to next season?
Not yet. I'm going to enjoy different things we do now in the off season, making speeches, going from place to place and having people all over the country congratulate us for what we accomplished. And then once the holidays are over with, once January comes around, then we'll get ourselves pumped up and get ready to go, because by that point we're only about 6 weeks away.
Right. Well, congratulations on this year and your years in general with the Yankees. It's been a great run for you. So thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Joe Torre is the manager of the Yankees. His new book is called Joe Torre's Ground Rules for Winners. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. From Hogshead Beer and Wine of the Month Clubs, select microbrews and wines delivered to homes or offices. 3, 6, or 12-month subscriptions available. 800-795-BEER. And from Random House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with actor Philip Seymour Hoffman about his roles in Boogie Nights, Next Stop Wonderland, Happiness, and his new film Flawless, in which he plays a drag queen. And Ken Tucker reviews the new double CD by Nine Inch Nails. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Philip Seymour Hoffman gave terrific performances in three of the more interesting movies of the past couple of years, Boogie Nights, Happiness, and Next Stop Wonderland. He's in two films coming out soon, Magnolia and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Hoffman is currently starring in the film Flawless. He plays a drag queen who has a cabaret act. His downstairs neighbor is a homophobic retired security guard played by Robert De Niro. Early in the film, the security guard is disabled by a stroke, which affects his facial muscles, making it difficult for him to speak intelligibly. When his physical therapist advises him that singing lessons will help him talk again, the only cheap and easy way to get them is to ask his drag queen neighbor to become his teacher. In this scene, De Niro asks Hoffman how he became a drag queen. Hoffman explains that as a child, he was always miscast as big male characters in musicals like The Snow Queen.
We were all on stage, and they had made these dry ice kettles so they could smoke come out of them, you know? And one night, all of a sudden, one dry ice kettle exploded, and dry ice flew everywhere, right? Well, Pretty Little Miss No Talent, who was playing the Snow Queen, dashed off the stage screaming and pulling her hair out. Well, the play must go on, I believe, and she had dropped a crown. Well, honey, I just picked up that crown, put it on my head, and I was the greatest damn Snow Queen in the history of PS11 Paramus, New Jersey. And, I've been wearing dresses ever since. But I don't like the term drag queen, you know, because most drag queens just want to, you know, parade around looking flawless, you know, and if they sing, you know, they lip sync to records. And I'm a singer, and I'm a female impressionist. I'm an artist, you know?
Well, it's you're a drag queen.
Let me savor those lovely words for a moment. All right, what are you, channeling Jesse Helms?
What did you do to try to make this character a real person and not just a stereotype of a drag queen?
Well, hey, I had a good start. I wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel like the story had the possibility of playing a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this story had that possibility because of the transgender issue, where I wasn't just going to be playing some, you know, entertaining, flamboyant drag queen character, which isn't very interesting to me. What's interesting to me is this person I really had to look at the fact that there was somebody who woke up every morning with a task at hand, which is how can I be the best woman I can be? You know, and that's his task from the minute he wakes up, you know, and I found him researching this role and practicing this role that it was very hard to be the best woman I could be, because physically and vocally I had everything going against me.
Like what?
Like that I have a very low voice and I have a body that I'm like 5'10", I weigh 200 pounds and, you know, I'm kind of built like a wrestler. And so I didn't have much feminine about me to work from. And so in going at this character, I realized the frustration I was coming up against was really the humanity of this character. It was the frustration and the task at hand every day and how hard he was going to work at get going after and being the thing he wanted to be and the life he wanted to live. And that's really where I found this real person, you know, that's what he, every moment he's kind of saying, do you see me? Do you hear me? He's like, you know, look at me, don't ignore me. You know, I want to be seen as the way I want to be seen. I want to, you know, he's working toward the life he needs and wants.
Well, we can hear your voice on radio now, and which, as you say, is really quite deep. Tell us what you did with your voice for the character of Rusty.
I just, you know, obviously manipulated it, but it was kind of a mesh. I just through documentaries and tapes I was watching, I found these three different gentlemen who were all, and one of them actually had gone through the operation, and he was the least flamboyant of the other two, because he wasn't in the entertainment world. He was an accountant or something. I can't remember. But then the other two characters were in the kind of the entertainment world, but not really, but they went to the drag shows and the balls and things like that. And they were, those two characters were extraordinarily feminine, their voice and the way that they carried themselves. But the guy who was the accountant or whatever he was, something like that, wasn't. He was struggling, and he had gone through the complete operation. And so they had a lot of, they had some footage of him where he actually was holding a mirror up to his face, trying, you know, saying, good morning, and like really trying to sound feminine and the way he looked. And that was the most fascinating thing I think I saw in my research, because what it told me was the effort and the time that they would put into, you know, not only, you know, the operation, but they had to actually practice. And so the combination of these three characters is kind of where I found this voice that I didn't really mimic, but it kind of informed and helped me get at something that I felt was accurate.
What was it like to look at yourself as Rusty, dressed as a woman with lipstick and, you know, a woman's clothes? Was it interesting to stare at yourself in a mirror that way, or see yourself on film that way?
It's very interesting. I staring myself in the mirror was going back to the thing I was saying earlier, that it just showed how bad a woman I was and how sad that was to me. Because there is this thing, because there's this pride of wanting to play this part, and you want to just kind of do yourself up and start acting this role and just be like, wow, I'm hot. Look at me, I'm a woman. And, you know, it's just the furthest thing from the truth. And it helped inform who this guy was for me, the struggle that he was going to go through. But that was one thing. But then when I watched the film itself, it was just kind of spooky, because I wasn't able to, and this doesn't always happen, this rarely happens actually, I wasn't able to remember doing it.
You weren't able to remember doing the film?
Yeah, I remember doing it, but I would be watching these scenes, I'm like, what was I doing? You know, like, how did I do that? I don't remember. You know, it was very, a very weird experience, because it was just so odd to see me like that. I think that was what was happening. It was odd for me to watch me like that, because it is very different from me. And I enjoyed it. I was happy. I was proud of it. But there was an odd feeling of, like, did I do that? Well, I was watching it, kind of a surreal feeling.
I think a lot of actors have the ambition of someday working with De Niro. You both had to do things that were very physically different for you. He's playing somebody who had a stroke and is partially paralyzed, and you're playing someone who's transgendered, a man dressing as a woman. So, like, you know, you're both having to really go to extremes. In this, what was it like watching him work and get into his character with a partially paralyzed face and body?
Well, it's exactly it. It's he does meticulous work, and he's a perfect example of kind of what I'm talking about. You know, he shows up to the set and he's this very healthy man, De Niro. You know, he's very strong. He's still got a very young physique. You know, and a lot of energy, and he comes there in the morning, and there he is, and then he starts to put on some prosthetics and do the work he needs to do, and all of a sudden he's this guy who can't walk and can't talk, and how he informs that role is beautiful, but here he is coming in the morning, like, you know, in better shape than I am. So that's what it's like working with him, is seeing him do the meticulous work and the interpretive work that he does to get at what you eventually see, you know. And it did help me, because he was very calm about it and relaxed about it and step by step about it and A to B to C about it. And that's how you should be, because the movie sets move along so quickly, and there's a lot of panic and tension, and we got to get shot. We got to get done today or everyone will die type mentality. And so when an actor comes in of his stature and kind of says, I need to do what I need to do to get where I got to get, and he slowly does that, it's helpful to me.
My guest is Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's currently starring with Robert De Niro in Flawless. We'll talk about his other movies after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Seymour Hoffman, and he stars with Robert De Niro in the new film Flawless. Let's talk about some of your early films, or earlier films. Let's start with Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
And just to recap our listeners' memories, Burt Reynolds stars as a porn director in the 1970s who wants to make the kind of movies where people come for the plot, not just for the sex. And Mark Wahlberg plays his young discovery who becomes a star in the porn world. And you're part of the film crew. You have a crush on the Mark Wahlberg character. And at a party, you kind of overcome your inhibitions, invite him to come outside to take a look at your new red sports car. Then you give him a big kiss on the lips. And I want to play the clip of what happens here after that. Here's Mark Wahlberg's reaction.
I'm sorry, sir.
What the hell is the matter with you?
I'm sorry.
Why did you do that, Scotty?
You look at me sometimes.
What?
I want to know if you like me.
Well, of course. Yeah, I like you, Scotty.
Can I kiss you?
Scotty,
please,
I don't...
Please, can I kiss you on the mouth?
No!
Please let me.
Scotty!
I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to grab you like that or scare you or anything.
It's all right, man.
Do you want to kiss me or...
Scotty.
No?
What's the matter with you?
I forget it. I'm really drunk. Really, I am. I'm out of my head. I'm really wasted. Really, Dirk,
yeah,
I'm really just wasted.
That.
I'm crazy right now. I'm really crazy.
Do you want to go back inside?
Do you like my car, Dirk?
What?
I mean...
Yeah.
Because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make sure you thought it was cool or else I was going to take it back.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's great, Scotty.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Scotty.
I love you. I really love you.
I love you too, Scotty.
Okay.
Let's go back inside, okay?
All right. All right.
After that happens, you go into your new red sports car and you're crying, I'm such an idiot.
Mm.
Tell us about creating this character, someone who's surrounded by beautiful people who have sex on screen, and he's very repressed, doesn't really accept his homosexuality, thinks he's incredibly unattractive and overweight.
I can't tell you how much fun we had doing that film, all of us. But yeah, I did have to play the guy whose shirt didn't go over his belly and tight shorts and the long hair and stuff, but that was all my choice. You know, I did that. But, you know, no one put me in those clothes. That was my choice. I did that. I did all those things, that character. So, you know, I have to live with it. All the good things and all the bad things that go with it. But I do think that that's who he was, and that's kind of how, honestly, I wanted to play him. And I do think it was honest. And it was the only way I felt that that character could be played with any... depth to it. You know, I just had a strong feeling that this character, who was, he was my age, but basically he was 13, so I did a lot of literal expressions of that. The literal stuff was the costume. I mean, I basically wore a wardrobe of a 13-year-old. You know, I remember when we were doing the trying on the clothes, I kept saying smaller, 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 and they're like, well, we're going into Macy's rack now, they said. That made me feel good. But then there, I was just, you know, how does a guy from the valley talk? You know, how does a guy who's really affected, doesn't know he's gay, from the valley talk? You know, and I just came up with it. I just had a lot of different voices in my head, and I kind of meshed them all together and came up with this voice, and it seemed right. And then it informed how I moved my body And then I just do all the internal work, which I always do, which is, you know, what's it like to just, you know, what's it like to obsess about somebody? You know, what's it like to want somebody so bad? What's it like to go through the day and not be able to think about anything else but this one person? You know, and you just go from there and see what happens. I'm proud of the choices we made there, and Paul was really helpful all the whole way through. He was cautious at first when I brought in what I did, and then we just nurtured it together, and we both, I remember after shooting it and seeing it, I remember going to him and saying, thank you for letting me do what I did, and I think we did right by this part you wrote.
My guest is Philip Seymour Hoffman. Let's move on to another of your films, and this is Happiness. Now, in Happiness, everyone has some strange, usually unsavory quirk, and your character, you play someone who's very repressed sexually.
Yeah.
Stays home and basically his only sexual companion is himself. He makes these anonymous sexual calls. At the beginning of the film, we see you with your psychiatrist and you're telling him about the obsession you have with your neighbor. and you describe what you want to do with her, what you would do if you could get your hands on her. You'd undress her, you'd tie her up, and then you do a lot of things that I couldn't mention on the radio. And here's what happens next.
But she doesn't even know I exist. I mean, she knows I exist. I mean, we are neighbors, you know. We, you know, smile politely at each other, but I don't know I could ever really begin to talk to her. I mean, what can I talk about? I have nothing to talk about. I'm boring. I know. I've been told before, so don't tell me it's not true, because it's a fact. I bore people. People look at me and they get bored. People listen to me and they zone out, bored.
As you're saying this to your therapist, he's picking lint off of his pants very distractedly.
Yes, yes.
And then he starts to mentally run through his to-do list and his shopping list.
Yeah.
Now this is not the kind of role to make you think, hey, he's perfect leading man material.
No, it's not.
Did you have any concerns about that?
Nah, because I think he's repressed in a lot of ways, this guy. This character kind of is in his own orbit. Compared to most characters I've played. So I had to play him. It was one of those had to things. I read it, and it was just so fantastically written. And when I was auditioning for it, I auditioned about a billion times, and Todd was so specific with me, and I just knew. When I got the part, I remember my agent called me and goes, well, you got it. I had auditioned like 5 times. And I remember going, oh, boy. That was the first thing I said. I was like, "Well, do I really want that?" But I was kidding. Meaning, like, I was excited. I was excited to play this part. It's a great part. It's one of the best parts I've ever been given. I was lucky to get it.
Now, you put a lot of tension into your voice for this part.
Yeah. That again was another thing that just, like I said, the non-literal thing coming back up again. You know, how am I going to interpret how this guy behaves? I don't know. Sometimes he talks just like me. Sometimes he walks and acts just like me. But sometimes I was playing this part. I remember I was just doing something one day, and I was kind of working on it. And I just knew that he was kind of caving in on himself all the time. And so with the shoulders over and the caving in the chest, and just the voice kind of, the face kind of caved into, and that's the voice that came. I know that none of this makes any sense. It's just actor mumbo jumbo, but that's kind of what happened. So I had this weird voice.
Tension, no energy.
Tension, yeah. He's just kind of caving in on himself, you know, which made him sound different, that's all.
Let me get to another great film you were in, and that's Wonderland. Real different kind of film, you know, a romantic comedy, and a really different kind of role. In this one, let's see, I'm going to play a clip from the opening scene in which Hope Davis, who plays the girlfriend who you live with, comes home to find that you've taken all your things, you've packed the car with them, and you're ready to drive off and leave her.
I didn't mean it to be this way. The reasons why I'm leaving are on this tape. It points out the 6 points of why I think our relationship is doomed and why I'm leaving. You can watch it later. I was gonna mail it, but now I'll just give it to you now.
Are you taking your VCR? Did you leave that up there?
I bought the VCR. I'm taking my VCR. I bought the only thing I'm taking.
What is that on top of the car? Is
that
a futon on top of the car?
That's our futon. That's my futon. Can I please take the futon? Please? Violence is not the answer!
Don't be driving back here in a couple days, okay?
Oh.
I'm not going through this over and over and over.
I'm not. That's on the tape. I think that's point number 4 on the tape, because I have my vision, you have your vision, and I'm leaving because the Tantoonies need me. The Ten Toonies.
What?
It's an Indian tribe. It was in the newspaper. It was on CNN. You don't even watch TV. You don't read the paper. You don't know what's going on in the world. That's one of my reasons. That's point one.
But you can't just walk out.
No, I know.
You can't just walk out,
listen,
Sean.
Listen, I'm going to go, and I'm not coming back. Please take Fidel.
I'm not taking Fidel, Sean.
Please take
I'm not
Fidel.
Taking your cat.
I don't have the time and energy to take care of the cat. I have to go and get something accomplished. That cat will be in the way. Ow! I am a man of peace. You are a woman of violence. I'm not a man like that. And you're turning me into that man. That's like point number 8.
This is a real departure for you because you're playing a kind of slightly magnified version of your standard self-righteous and sensitive boyfriend. You know, there's a whole genre of person who fits that category.
Yeah. No, it's funny because every part you play, there's a genre.
You know, that's what I found out, is that every part you play, somebody's played that type of role 10 million times before. And that's kind of the job, is what new light do you want to shine on that part or that story? And in Next Up Wonderland, that was kind of my take on that whole thing.
Were there people you could base this on? I mean,
we all know guys
like this, yeah.
Everybody knows people like this. I mean, I just remember college. Just college came to me. It was about three people in college that just completely jumped right at me when I read that thing. You know, roommates I had or whatever. That just, you know, that righteous state of mind, you know. That righteous, strong, I'm on the soapbox. I got to keep talking or I'm going to die. You know, I right. just know those guys. You know, I've been one of those guys. Who hasn't, you know, in one way or another? So I just kind of created him simply, you know, very simply, very much me in a way. But the way he his actions and how he, you know, how loud he is and how aggressive he is really the key to that role. You know, I had a lot of fun playing that role. We had a lot of improv that role.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, he's now starring in Flawless. Coming up, Nine Inch Nails' new CD. This is Fresh Air. Nine Inch Nails is the group name for Trent Reznor and a shifting array of musicians. Reznor's previous release, The Downward Spiral, in 1994, set a new standard in high-volume hard rock. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that Nine Inch Nails' new double CD, The Fragile, is an ambitious work that won't disappoint fans and may impress hard rock skeptics.
Contrary to the chorus of the title song on The Fragile, Trent Reznor's music is all about letting things fall apart. Relationships, alliances, sanity. This is the bread and butter of loud rock and roll, music whose primary audience is adolescents who are undergoing extremes of emotion and who crave extreme soundtracks to accompany them through their turbulent lives. Trent Reznor may be 34 years old, but he seems to have no trouble slipping into the teen mindset to punch out a steel fist of a song.
Yeah.
A typical Nine Inch Nails composition builds slowly, quietly at first. It takes its time, gradually increasing in volume to often ear-cracking intensity. The lyrics tend to be simple rants. That song I just played is constructed around the catchy chorus, "This is what it feels like to be wretched." On another track called Into the Void, Reznor talks about, quote, "trying to save myself, but myself keeps slipping away." It's this idea of the alienated self that his audience responds to most intensely, and it extends even to what might be considered a love song called We're in This Together. Reznor's music is bluntly effective, even if his lyrics don't quite scan. Sorry, but I think it's pretty funny when he bellows about, quote, "watching fate as it flows down the path we have chose." It's chosen, Trent. Chosen. Some of you post-adolescent listeners won't be surprised if I tell you that Reznor has been heavily influenced by groups like Kiss and Pink Floyd. The Fragile is, in a way, Reznor's version of Pink Floyd's The Wall. Reznor even employed veteran hard rock producer Bob Ezrin to rough up the final versions of a number of songs here. The result is a strong, sure, if occasionally silly piece of work, grandly ambitious, foolhardy, and vastly entertaining. Let's hope it also helps a lot of teenagers through the dark nights of their souls.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of John Glenn, a memoir. Astronaut, war hero, senator, husband, and father, John Glenn tells his story. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. From Delacorte Press, publisher of I'll Be Home for Christmas, a compilation from the Library of Congress's archives, commemorating those who kept the spirit of Christmas alive during World War II. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a reflection on gambling and loss. We talk with Frederick and Stephen Barthelmy, brothers, college professors, and writers. Their new memoir, Double Down, is about their long and losing gambling spree that coincided with the loss of their parents. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.